I think the news media made a little bit bigger the deal out of it than they should have, but I guess with what happened to Columbus mission, Columbia, years back, I guess every little thing is going to make the news media's ears go up. Of course, they replaced the pump in the bathroom that definitely made the news. So that was successful. It was successfully done, as well as a couple of other things. Let me drop it. There was a spacewalk to check the 10-foot diameter ring arm that is rotator. I've got the name of it now. This piece that they call the alpha rotating joint that turns the 240-foot by 40-foot solar panels. Well, that's one set, and there's another set as well hooked up to it. And it turns those panels. You got one set up like that on the starboard side, and one set up like that on the port side. Although port side, they only have the one set of panels up there. The next set will eventually go up next year. That will complete the station. But they did do a spacewalk to check that out, and they got some tape. What the taped it to the metal to find out what this metal shavings that they see on that joint. They want to figure out what it is and what to do about this thing. This thing rotates that whole assembly every 90 minutes to properly face the sun. Not that it's always in the sun all the time. I think one third of the time the space station is not in the sun. They can't do anything about that. It's running at a 56 degree inclination relative to the equator. So, it's always going to be partially in shade one third of the time. But the ability to rotate these solar panels will help tremendously when they have all these labs up and running. They're going to need the power eventually. Instead of a three-man crew, they'll have a six-person crew. So that's the latest on the space station in Phoenix. Very good talk about the Voyager and all that before. I'm very interested in listening to all those old spacecraft. Some of them still working. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
Very fine, Paul. Let me ask you a couple of further questions. What is the current thinking in the case of Phoenix when they finally do get down to the ice? Is there any guess as to what percentage of it will be carbon dioxide ice versus water ice? I know until they do the experiment, they won't be sure of it, but is anybody making any guesses on that one? No, Paul, go ahead.
Well, according to the Odyssey spacecraft that's in orbit of Mars, there's three operating spacecraft presently in orbit of Mars. We have Odyssey and we have Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and the European Space Agency. They have Mars Express. But when Odyssey went over there a few years back, they discovered through one of their sensors hydrogen signature below the soil, and that anytime they see that, they believe that would be H2O. The only way hydrogen could exist usually would be in water in that kind of environment. So they kind of knew there was ice down there under the ground, under the soil, and that's why they chose that area to go to it. If you look at the map of what Odyssey laid out, and it's big, and we're talking about bigger than the United States, this whole area on the North Pole. They took the lowest area that extended down a little bit to try to keep the land not too far north. They wanted as far south as they could to do this work. They did want to try to extend the life of the spacecraft as long as possible. It will only be a 3-month mission. It's this won't be like Spirit and Opportunity. Let me drop the thing. They needed to dig this ice out, and I believe it is ice, not carbon dioxide. When you 3 months from now, when winter starts to set in the northern hemisphere of Mars, eventually the solar panels will go dark. They won't be getting enough light from the sun. That will be the first thing that's going to happen. The next thing that's eventually going to happen is there will be buildup of carbon dioxide on the surface of Mars, right there, right where the lander is. Will get higher and higher and higher. And you remember, you got to remember, when you look at the Phoenix spacecraft, if you were to stand next to it, it would be up, where the panels are would probably be up to your waist. So it's a pretty big thing. Platform is pretty high. So it's predicted that this platform will almost be covered, or maybe even covered with carbon dioxide in the middle of the winter there. So this is not going to be one of these extended missions. And of course, at that time, you're going to have plenty of carbon dioxide. But no, right now they predict from the Odyssey test that it is ice water, or water ice, as they call it, underneath the surface of Mars in that area. Back to you, Dan.
Glad to hear that. There were some news reports with reference to the space station shuttle link-up that there was a mysterious unidentified flying object flying along with the space station, which was believed to have come from a shedding of one of the tiles or clips or whatever from the space shuttle. And I think they were also claiming that there was a improper heat tile on the leading edge of the vertical stabilizer of the space shuttle. The news reports I read then, not very many, just one news report, would lead you to believe there was some concern about whether or not a burn-through could take place of the leading edge of the vertical stabilizer. I guess you're saying that all turned into a basically false alarm and the landing did take place safely. So did they finally identify what that improper-looking chunk of vertical stabilizer was? And did they finally identify what the unidentified flying object was? Back to you, Paul.
I know they saw the clip that holds the blanket in place. They said that they identified that as floating away. They don't know about the vertical stabilizer, Dick. Don't know about that one. I know they go over it with a fine-tooth comb with their orbiter arm. Talking about arms, they have an arm inside the spacecraft is normally 50 feet long. Since the Columbia disaster, they have another 50-foot section that goes on top of that. So now it becomes a 100-foot arm. So they're able to do a complete inspection on all the leading edges and everywhere on the spacecraft before they come back. When they disconnect from the International Space Station, they do a complete inspection with that arm. And I'm sure they must have checked it out and seen everything was okay. So I don't know about the vertical stabilizer, but I'm sure it was all checked out. They didn't hear anything after that. The orbital arm is extension pieces. Is the one that was left up there by the last space shuttle. They knew that Discovery was not going to have enough room for this gigantic Kaibo cylinder or new room that they put up there, a new lab built by Japan. And they had left that mechanism, that 50-foot extension, up there last time. And Discovery wasn't able to do a complete investigation on the way to the space station. They usually do that before and after leaving the space station. This time they did a rough, viewing with the 50-foot extension, but a of course, before they came back, they did have the new section attached. They brought that back with them. So, yeah, Dick, good to see that land, and the next mission, October, is going to be the Hubble Space Telescope rescue or service mission. Back to you, Dick.
3-8-4-1. Joe recognized, first call, is there any other mission between now and the Hubble repair mission, or is the very next mission the Hubble repair?
The Hubble repair is October, nothing in between. And then I think the next one after that would probably be, I think it's December or January, and that'll be the third part of this Kaibo lab that the Japanese built. They'll bring that up, and then I think maybe the following mission after that might be the solar panel. I don't know if they did away with the cupola at the viewing area. I know they were trying to cut costs. They were going to do away with that. Hope not. It sounds like a real cool thing to do. But basically, they're getting toward the end. Final missions, 2010, they'll shut it down. A lot of the missions after that will be bringing up spare parts of things that they're going to attach to the space station, things that they'll need in the future. They bring up plenty of supplies. And things. You're going to see a lot of cargo missions go up next year or even in 2010. So this thing is pretty well built, Dick, and you're not going to see that many more building missions. A couple, like I said, another big solar panel and third part of the lab. I think that's the cupola, if they put that on, that would be pretty neat. I'll have to check to see if they've done away with that. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine. Thank you, Paul. Joe, W2RYY, go ahead.
Hey, Dick. My question is related directly to the subject you're talking about. I heard tell that listening to the NASA channel, that there's only about 10 more missions, supposedly, that they're going to be flying the shuttle. I don't recall what replaces the shuttle, but my question relating to that was, when do they plan on testing or flying what's going to be replacing the shuttle?
Yeah, that's a good one for Paul. So when do they start testing the shuttle replacement is number one, and number two, you told us a lot of cargo is going to be brought up in the next year or so. Will that be Progress missions or another vehicle? Over to you, Paul.
Well, cargo missions, they need parts, spare parts. Things break up, there's going to be replacement parts in place on the station to do things in the years to come. So that type of thing. I haven't seen a manifest of the equipment, but there's going to be things that are going to be attached all over that space station. Everything from tanks to, nitrogen tanks to oxygen generators and oxygen tanks themselves and God knows what else. Probably all kinds of spare motors every time, in case something breaks. If something is needed in the future, then it will be brought up by Progress machine, spacecraft by Russia, or the ATV, automatic transfer vehicle, built by the European Space Agency, which carries 3 to 4 times more cargo than the Progress machine. The Progress machine is a spacecraft. So that's the story on that. I could go into the... I'll give you a rundown of the next mission after 2010. The space shuttles will be put in museums, and you have what's called a Constellation program coming up. Dick, should I go into that?
Yes, go ahead. Give us a little thumbnail sketch on what is Constellation, how big, how does it differ from the space shuttle, and how soon do you think they start testing it?
Okay, I'll try to keep it brief. I get carried away. Three main parts of this whole Constellation program. One would be the Orion spacecraft itself. Two would be the Ares rocket that will launch the Orion spacecraft. The Orion spacecraft now will carry the astronauts, up to 6 astronauts. The third part of this whole Constellation program would be the Ares V rocket launcher. That's going to be a heavy cargo lifter with no people on board. So, and this thing is going to have, you know, it's the equivalent, if not bigger, than what Saturn V had. Saturn V was, I think, 8 million pounds. Thrust, this thing, I think, it's supposed to be 9 million pounds. So this is a big cargo lift vehicle that's going to be built. Orion spacecraft, primary goal will be eventually to go to the moon. They want to establish a base up there. So what they'll have is the Orion spacecraft gets launched on the Ares rocket, put that into Earth orbit, and then the cargo lift vehicle will go up with the lunar lander on board. They'll have a lunar lander attached to it. The two will dock in space. They can prove that, you know, there's other rockets that are going to be attached to it. It'll be able to launch, go to the moon, stay there for maybe weeks at a time, eventually months at a time, and then return. When they do that, there'll be 4 astronauts involved. Orion spacecraft is built for multi-purposes. The idea is that you're going to be able to use this spacecraft for everything. It will be able to be built to carry people to the moon and eventually back from the moon. And it will also be, in the future, used to go to Mars. That's the theory. I tend to doubt that. I think everyone would dig on that. But that's the idea. And the other main purpose will be to go to the International Space Station when we drop it. Spacecraft kind of looks like the old Saturn, the old Apollo spacecraft. It's capsule looking, except it's almost twice as big. In fact, they designed it twice as big, but they shortened it a little bit for aerodynamic purposes, and also to be put properly onto the Ares space rocket that's going to launch it. But you're going to have 6 people on board. 2 will be up sitting up high, and like a lower deck, they'll have 4 more people. And this is how they'll go to get the International Space Station. The Americans, the Russians, of course, will still be going using their Soyuz spacecraft. And that's it. I would say 2000, and look for a launch around 2014. It'll be roughly a 4-year lag between the space shuttle and the Orion spacecraft. Similar delays that you had, similar to, I think we had a 3-year delay after Challenger. I think it was roughly a 2-year delay after, a year and a half or so after Columbia. What kind of a delay did we have after Skylab? I think that was, 1975-ish? That was roughly a 5-6-year delay before the space shuttle went up. So that's roughly it. Dick, back to you. WS tonight.
That delay sounds like a problem, though, Paul. If we stopped using the shuttle in 2010, and if the Orion is not available to replace it in 2014, that implies that there's a 4-year period in time where the only human transport to and from the International Space Station is by way of Soyuz, the Soviet rocket system. That sounds to me like there's very little backup in that technique. Are we sure that we should be abandoning the shuttle that soon? What do you feel on that one, Paul?
I would keep it flying, Dick, but you know, it did have a 25-year lifespan, or 100 flights each, whichever came first. Remember those statistics when they first came out, those predictions. I guess the 25 years is really coming to an end. I feel they can keep going, but that's not going to happen. You do have the only way up by Soyuz. And if you ask Peggy Whiteson, the last commander of the International Space Station, when she came back, I don't think she's too crazy about the idea. That thing had some big problems on the way back. It's a rocket stage that didn't separate properly from the spacecraft when it was coming down, and finally it did separate. But I mean, this thing was burning. Starting to burn. Craft was going, starting to, you know, go wildly through the atmosphere. It wasn't a smooth landing. It's happened before, Dick. So, you know, you've got an aged system that the Russians are dealing with. And, I'm not crazy about the idea, but that's the story. And that's, you know, we'll be able to put usually maybe one American on board every flight. The Soyuz holds three. That's it. Three up, three down. Back to you, Dick.
Sounds to me like you have similar concerns to me. Anyone else want to add any questions or comments to what Paul just said? Give me a call at us right now. Okay. I think it's time to go over to Mel's mailbag. Also, Mel, I think the next weekend is the Field Day event, and maybe you and I have our date. K2KEY. K2RIW.
No, not next week, Dick. This is K2KEY. Weekend of June 28th. Following week from next weekend. So don't show up next weekend. He won't find me there. So, we have a date, Dick. Let's see. What's new? Let me think. Well, let's talk about what's happening, strange things. You know, we were talking about the HARP project and all that. I don't know if it's got a bearing on it, but we've had some unusual conditions this past week. And some said that the NOAA report of seeing remains of the Cycle 24 sunspot is partially causing this strange condition, but not really sure. So I thought maybe as part of our space information series, we could include a few words on propagation and what's happening with the sunspot cycle right now. This past week, for instance, we had only openings, unusual great openings on 30 meters, that's 10.1 megahertz. And I monitored, I listened on 20 meters, nothing almost to speak of. 40, yes, had activity, but 30 meters was hopping. Now, why? I cannot explain that again. This morning on the 10-meter net, we had great local, well, I should say openings all over most of the United States, continental United States, had a lot of check-ins from different areas of the United States, so we did have some unusual opening on 10 meters. We can't really get a definite answer of what is going on right now, but why, could you in any way enlighten us why 10 megahertz should be some type of magical situation and your knowledge, Dick, over?
No. If you had told me that 40 meters was underskipping and 20 meters was overskipping, and 10 meters, correction, 30 meters, midway between the two, was giving you just the right range to the particular guys that you wanted to talk to, that would make a little bit of sense. But you make it sound like 30 had a significant opening and nothing unusual was happening on 20 and 40. I have no explanation. I'd love to know, let's see, we're not going to read about that in World Above 50 Meg, because it's not above 50 Meg. There must be a monthly column somewhere that discusses propagation, Mel, and maybe you can tell us where it is, whether it be the Radio Society of Great Britain or one of the CQ amateur radio or CQ VHF magazines. I'm not an HFer, so I don't keep track of that. So when it comes to studying propagation, who is your favorite guru, and what magazine has a nice column that discusses that, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, I get the weekly propagation reports and happenings as far as what NOAA and all is doing. I get it as a email from the ARRL, from that gentleman that does that research for the ARRL out in, I think he's out in the state of Washington, I believe. Can't think of his call right now, but he does quite a extensive report every week. And the point that he brought out, he says the only thing he can, you know, really figure possibly that it's related to is we're just finishing up cycle 23, and the new cycle has not really taken hold at all. It's still been zero, basically, but there's one or two unusual situations of cycle 23 still showing up. And why is it doing this to the 10 megahertz, the 30 meter band, is not quite clear. You know, what actually, how is it, you know, really getting the ionosphere to work this way for that particular frequency. So he hasn't come up with any definitive answer either as of this moment, Dick, but the 30 meter band, like I say, was extremely good. The all parts of Europe the other night, night before that, all parts of the Pacific. I was able to, now remember, the people are all held down to a low power, and at the same time, most of them are using fairly modest antennas. I think from all of my work, I didn't hear of any kind of yaggy type of situation. Mostly all these dipoles, verticals, and slopes. So I have no answer either, Dick, over.
Okay, maybe somebody will explain it in the future. What was your shortest DX and your longest DX? Have you heard anything like this on the 30-meter band before? And what's the total length of time you've been on the 30-meter band? Can you put out 100 watts on that band, Mel? Go ahead.
Yes, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I run just 100 watts. I think the maximum is about 150 watts on that band. Yeah, we do share it with... that's another thing. The military uses a number of teletype transmitting systems on that band. I hear them. In fact, I use them basically as was sort of my beacon. I know the one that's down right on the bottom of the band there. When that thing is really coming in quite strong, I don't really know where it is. I tried a couple times with teletype to try to, you know, copy it, but no avail. Whether they're using some kind of code or whatever they're doing, I just cannot I can see it on the scope that I'm definitely tuning the mark and space correctly, but can't make heads or tails of what the heck it's all about. However, the signals, when I know when those teletype stations are quite strong, I know the 30-meter band has definitely got an opening. It's also a strictly CW band. Openings were to all parts of Europe. I'm telling you, every country in Europe, every 2 kilohertz, you found another country in Europe. And the night, couple nights before that, was open to the Pacific from the Marshall Islands, Hawaii, the Marshall Islands. I had contacts right to New Zealand and Australia, Dick, just using the 100 watts and a one of those sloping verticals that we talked about over.
Have the Europeans had 30 meters longer than us or at the same time as us, Mel? Is it one of the so-called walk band frequency assignments? And from your experience, are the Europeans making more use of 30 meters than the United States? Back to you, Mel.
In its heyday, I remember a few years ago when the conditions were real great, it was a really top-notch CW band. Everybody that was running modest equipment, in fact, you would see a lot of kits and homebrew QRP products that were basically bent on making, you know, these one-band rigs available for 30 meters because, like I say, basically low power stations and all, QRP was very popular. And I know that a number of European places and other places I worked, many of them had homebrew transceivers strictly for the one band, the 30 meters. And I've been involved with 30 meters basically since we got that band, and I guess it's 20 years at least by now. And as I say, when the band was really in great shape a few years ago, I was operating, I would say, a majority of my CW was on 30 meters. Then it went dead. And I monitored, I try it, I call and everything. You could hear those teletype stations occasionally, but extremely weak, very, very weak. So I don't know where, again, where they are exactly, but I guess they were able to get copy on those stations. They're most likely running tremendous amount of power, but they were very weak at times, Dick, and I know that at that point there was any amateur radio activity over.
Interesting. Okay. As long as a whole lot of people observe this unusual propagation you're talking about, I'd like to believe sometime in the future somebody will study all the right charts, figure out what took place and why. Was it the sunspot cycle doing it, even though we're down in the basement, so to speak? Who knows? Maybe it's time we open the mailbag, Mel. Any interesting emails this week? KQLIW?
Well, yes, we always get some, should I say, colorful. Okay, I can't read the colorful ones, of course. So I'm going to read the ones that, as you say, the friendly candy company will not object to. I'm just looking for one right now. Okay, here's one. I was traveling in Italy, and there's a antenna that's marketed in Italy, and I brought it back, and it's an interesting antenna for 432. I don't know if it's marketed in this country or what you think of it. It's called a open quad for 432, and the advertisement I have that's translated from Italian, it says it's an easy adjustment of the quad, especially the reflector for better front-to-back ratio. Easy expectation of the driven element because of relatively high impedance at the feed point. Absence of feeders allow the exact phase of the expectation for top and bottom parasitic elements. High Q of the rector element will increase the gain. Double V configuration makes for a collinear effect, which lowers the vertical radiation path, and possibly of eventually inserting a smaller antenna for operation on more than one band. Now, what do you know about open quad for a 432? If you ever dealt with antennas, stick over.
First thing I better tell you is that the button on your push button switch is giving you a little bit of grief, but we still had 95% copy. When it comes to cubicle quads on 432, I'm having trouble thinking of the guy's name, lived in Hempstead. In the 1970 to 1975 era, I had lots of QSOs with him with his either 14 or 16 element cubicle quad Yagi antenna, wooden boom, something like a 16 gauge wire was the actual cubicle quad driven element reflector and directors, and the antenna worked quite well. But if you understand how a Yagi works, it is a driven element with a bunch of parasitic elements. The parasitic elements only have to present the right amount of reactance at the right position in space. And whether the element itself is made out of a dipole, a square, a triangle, a loop, or many other kinds of shapes, as long as at your particular polarization it presents the right amount of reactance at that point in space, you'll get the Yagi action. Now, open cubicle quad, does that mean the loop does not completely close? And if so, I know of no great advantage of doing that. So, looks like my knowledge on this one is a bit limited, and it's a bit dated. The only cubicle quad experience I had was way back to 1975. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, this is KTKEY. I know very little about it, to tell you the truth. Yeah, basically, I know what they do. I mean, I've seen something similar, I'm sure, where I could say they are opening. In other words, they take two, looks like, to make the quad, in other words, two pieces of wire, basically, in the shape of an L. And, of course, if you join them at the corner, you'd have a quad. But what you do, instead of joining them at the corner, you leave them open. So you'd have, like, the opposite corner open, in other words, diagonally from the point of support would be open. Now, let's see if I have any information other than he does describe it from what here. Uses the boom is 6.4 feet or 2 meters long. And it's made of fiberglass, fed with 50 ohm cable, and has a 75 ohm quarter matching section. And this sounds a little bit far-fetched, but this is what the advertisement says. Properly installed, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Five elements. Front forward gain of 15 dB over D. Over dipole. Front to back 24 dB. Front to side 40. Is that sound possible, Dick? Over.
First of all, depending on where I feed the cubicle quad, there's a point somewhere around the so-called circle of the quad where the current goes to zero. And if I open at that point, nothing happens, no real change. Second of all, five elements and 15 dB over dipole on 6 foot of length. Now, that's way beyond the capability of Yagi-like structures as studied by one of the world's experts, Gunter Hock, DL6WU, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform. He's had a whole series of articles on the world's best Yagi-like designs, whether they be loop Yagis, quad Yagis, dipole Yagis, and so on. And his curves would lead you to believe that the major determinant to the gain you can get out of a Yagi is the length of the boom. And whether you put a lot of elements in there or a fewer elements that are very well tuned, it's the length of the boom that does it. 15 dB of gain on 432 megacycles requires something like 13 feet of boom. And if he's doing it with 6 feet of boom, it sounds too good to be true. Now, we could be running into, let me drop, one of these situations where a person has measured the 3 dB beamwidth in azimuth and 3 dB beamwidth in elevation and interpreted that into gain. Beamwidth versus gain is a necessary but not sufficient. In other words, if 15 dB of gain over dipole requires 23 degrees of beamwidth or less, just because your antenna has 23 degrees of beamwidth doesn't mean it's got 15 dB of gain. It's a necessary but not sufficient. So I wonder, has he really measured gain? If I heard you correctly, 6 foot of boom and five elements and 15 over dipole, wow. I think it's 2-1 too good. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, that's right. That I thought to myself, doesn't sound like it's possible, but I never know, and I hate to make it a statement and then be proven wrong. So, I can say I don't know much about this antenna either, except I have seen some indication that there was experiments with so-called open quad elements that they are actually what they refer to them as a double V configuration element. And would that actually, if it was double V, if you picture two V, being joined together, on the same support with, and then the corners are left open, Could we actually consider that doing that? That would be a, what I guess, according to this, is supposed to be a collinear effect. Is that possible? Take over.
If you're only putting up three elements as a Yagi, and each one of them is an upper V and a lower V, you're going to get some increase in gain, as opposed to just using the lower V. But by the time you get out to 15 dB of claimed gain on 432, which means your effective capture area is a 5.5-foot diameter circle of space. 5.5 feet in diameter, but your upper V and your lower V are only separated by something like half a foot. Is that capable of increasing the effective capture area when it's all those elements are inside of the capture area you would have had automatically with just plain dipoles with 15 dB of gain on almost 13 feet of boom length? So for a long Yagi, I think the answer is no. And just because the upper V and the lower V are not connected to the sides, that in itself doesn't create magic. Because if you're feeding the center of the lower V, the upper V not being connected doesn't matter, because the right-hand side and the left-hand side of the joining point, so to speak, the current is zero out there. So the fact that they're open or closed, just as long as there's a little bit of capacitive coupling, so you are feeding energy into the upper V, doesn't matter. So the opening doesn't create magic. The extra spacing for a long Yagi doesn't create magic. I'm not convinced yet. If the person making the gain claim didn't do it by way of a reasonably well-calibrated comparison to a known gain antenna, then he hasn't really proven the gain. Back to you, Mel, KQRIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Now, I'm just reading a little further that the person who designed this antenna, I2RR, won in 1980 the shoot-off there in Italy as the antenna, I guess, for this band or whatever, however they run their contest or whatever test they run. He came out tops with this antenna design, Dick, so I have no idea. Possible? Who knows? I will never say, you know, anything until I really look at it carefully. But sounds quite interesting, you know, this concept of open element, open quad element. And I guess we, different antenna design sites we went through with that design of the Quaggy, which I find works for an excellent antenna on 432. I've used a Quaggy, and which, of course, you know who put that together, I believe, designed that, and it seems to be an extremely effective antenna on 432. So I don't know much about this other one, this open V-type of configuration, open quad-type configuration. All right, so anyhow, that's all the information I have on it, Dick, over.
Yeah, the Quaggy or Quad Yagi was done by Dr. Wayne Oberbeck, K6YNB, I think is what the call letters, Yankee November Bravo, and wooden boom Yagi, quad driven element and reflector, all the rest are directors in normal dipole manner. And the wooden boom Yagi in the dry area of Los Angeles is a fairly nice antenna. On the East Coast, where we get a fair amount of rain, unless you've done a very good job of weatherproofing that wooden boom, I'm pretty sure it's going to give you some grief. Because water at 432 is a very lossy material. And water that gets absorbed into that wooden boom and sits there in the middle of the elements is going to give you some decrease in performance. I'm a strong advocate of aluminum booms with the shoulder bushings holding the elements insulated from the boom. That, in my opinion, gives the most reliable antenna, the highest strength-to-weight ratio, the greatest longevity as far as weather survivability is concerned. And I competed against Wayne Overbeck's design, and I think it was 1978 or 1979 in a 10-game contest on the East Coast. And for its length and number of elements, the antenna did well, the Quad Yagi. But it didn't have any great magic that I could see. Very inexpensive, easily reproduced construction technique. I'm going to give you that. The fact that this open quad antenna of I2RR did such a good job in 1982 at an antenna contest is a good piece of evidence, but it's not yet proof. The fact that he won that antenna contest doesn't mean he has all the gain that he thinks he has. He just did well compared to the antennas that also appeared in that particular contest. And if it was run by the techniques that are used on the East Coast of the United States, where a known standard gain antenna is used as a comparison, and then you come to the conclusion that your new antenna is X number of dB better or worse than that known comparison antenna, then you've got a claim of gain that is more traceable to the Bureau of Standards. But without that comparison, the claim for gain is very difficult to justify. Beamwidth alone doesn't do it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Thanks, and this is K2KEY. All right, just brought it up because I thought it'd be very interesting to hear about. Always another one somewhere around. It seems like we never run out of the antenna design of one or another. Okay, shall we let this go, Dick, for the time being, and possibility somebody will make comments on it later on, and we can get more answers to this question of, you know, whether or not there is any really, you know, criteria to put together an antenna with open, you know, open elements like this. So I think we'll let this go for the time being, Dick, over.
Until we get more information, I think we have very little choice on that one, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay, the person that sent it to me, if you have any further information, we'll be more than glad to read about it and bring it up here on the TechNet. Thank you, anyhow, for your participation. Okay, want to try another one?
We've got a fair amount of time. Fire away.
Okay. Down here, especially for things that straightforward, you know, that we get into. Some of these questions are really a little too much, I think, for our TechNet to get involved with. I mean, people are sending me constantly questions that are more or less laboratory testing and mathematical analysis and all stuff very heavy on calculus and all what I think of the problem and the solution, and I don't think this is for the TechNet, nor do I think it should be involved. We should be in any way involved in it, Dick. I think this is out of the realm of amateur radio, and I think we'll just pass on those types of questions. Am I correct, over?
Yeah, we've got to use our judgment on that one, Mel. You and I have had occasional emails where somebody is studying electromagnetic theory in college. He was given a final exam with a very elaborate question on it. And the way electromagnetic theory and fields and waves course is taught in college, I've got some strong feelings that it can be done in a better way. You and I are looking for questions, answers, discussions that contains hands-on experience or ability for the amateurs listening to us to actually go out and build the thing. If you're helping the guy to find the right materials to build an antenna that has a proven performance, and he has trouble locating a particular component, or he wants to understand the theory of operation, that's reasonable. But to answer somebody's final exam question or his doctoral thesis question, first of all, I'm not sure we have the ability, but even if we did, it may be much too narrowband. You and I are trying to steer the TechNet so that the most number of people get a little bit of enjoyment, a little bit of information out of it. To answer a question that's good for two guys on the East Coast, and neither of which are listening to the TechNet right now, that's a little less than desirable for us to go there. Back to you, Mel.
I guess we're agreed on that point, Dick. Thank you. This is K2KDY. All right, I'm reading down first. Okay, here's an interesting question. To build that antenna tuner that you mentioned, Johnson Kilowatt Matchbox system, which uses basically the link tuning, and I'd like to use that. I'd like to build one of those tuners. Now, I noticed you said there's two types. The one you mentioned using two rotary inductors, and then you mentioned another one that basically uses L network. And the problem is that it uses, as you said, a dual differential capacitor. Now, what is a dual differential capacitor? Because I can't seem to obtain one, which you, of course, are going to have problems finding such a thing. I know that. And please explain, is there any way to put such a thing together to your knowledge? All right, well, I can tell you basically, you know, a homebrew version, simple enough. But all right, Dick, you say some words about dual differential capacitor, exactly what it is first, over.
I think it's usually a butterfly-like capacitor, dual differential. Yes, one kind is a butterfly kind. That's where you've got a left-hand rotor system and a right-hand rotor system. Ordinarily, the rotor and stator of an air variable capacitor, the rotor plates cover one half of a circle. The stator plates cover one half of a circle. So when it's fully meshed, when the two halves of the circle are fully meshed, you get maximum capacitance. When the two halves of the circle are such that you rotate the rotor and nothing is meshed, you get the minimum capacitance. The good news about that capacitor, or ordinary air variable capacitor, is you get the maximum range. The bad news is that the minimum capacitance is sometimes not as low as you want. Now, the butterfly capacitor, which I think is the kind that's called dual differential, means that you have not just a hemisphere, a half circle of rotor plates, you have a quarter circle of rotor plate, of stator plates and rotor plates. The stator plates are a quarter circle. In other words, they cover 90 degrees of the circle, and those plates are on the right-hand side with a contactor. Another set of stator plates cover a quarter of a circle, 90 degrees, on the left-hand side, and there's a contact between the two. And the rotor is a butterfly, which again has a rotary plate covering 90% of the 90 degrees of the circle, one quarter of the circle, on the right side and the left side. And when you rotate that thing so that all the plates, right side and left side, are fully meshed, that's your maximum capacitance. When you rotate 90 degrees from that, so that the rotor plates are strictly up and down, you have minimum capacitance. The advantage of that kind of a butterfly capacitor is what I call it, is that the minimum capacitance is a lot lower. The maximum capacitance isn't so high. The rotor is thoroughly floating, and there are certain kinds of circuits where you want the pair of terminals that are the main active terminals of the air variable capacitor to be floating from ground. Let me drop. So this butterfly capacitor gives you that effect. That's the good news. One piece of bad news of a dual differential or dual butterfly capacitor, the kind that I'm describing right now, one disadvantage is that it goes from maximum capacitance to minimum capacitance with only 90 degrees of rotation of the shaft. Whereas a more conventional air variable capacitor goes from maximum to minimum with 180 degrees of rotation. So you get more resolution of capacitance with the conventional design. You get a lower minimum capacitance with the butterfly design, as I call it. I think that's the dual differential, but I'm not absolutely sure. Another way of looking at this dual differential would be to again have 90 degrees of stator plates left side, 90 degrees of stator plates on the right-hand side, 90 degrees of the circle, one quarter of the circle, and only and the rotor has 90 degrees of either 90 or 180 degrees, but only a single set of plates on the rotor, not the upper and lower set, just a single set. Now you can make the rotor add capacitance to the left side or the right side in a differential manner. And there are certain kinds of tuning circuits where that's a benefit. I think it's a more rare one. So, as you can tell, I'm not completely sure. I've seen these devices that I've described. I'm not quite sure which ones have which name. K2KEY to take it. Drag your feet a little bit in case we have somebody on frequency with a little more knowledge on air variable capacitors. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, well, dual differential capacitor, of course I know quite a bit about them because going way back to our early days of radio, you know, they were very popular. Johnson, of course, was a very popular company that made variable capacitors, especially during World War II, a lot of surplus equipment. You'll definitely find Johnson capacitors in their variable capacitors. Basically, if you want to look at a dual differential capacitor, as far as I know, it actually is like two status sections. That's the best way to explain it. Two status sections with one rotary on it. In other words, one rotary shaft. So in other words, what's happening is one section is increasing in capacity, the other section is decreasing in capacity. Now, you can actually picture this if you took two, let's say, 0 to 100 PF capacitors, and let's say you tied the two shafts together with some kind of little pulley arrangement, you know, belting them together, set one to its maximum capacity, the other one to its minimum. You'll notice if you turn the shaft, if the one shaft that you're turning, you'll see that the capacity is one is decreasing while the other one is increasing. So there was a number of homebrew ideas that they came up with, but I think that's a pretty good description. Am I correct, Dick, by saying that as one is decreasing, the other one would be increasing because it has two status and one in between rotors in between on one shaft, over.
I've got a very nice picture of what you're describing, and I can easily see how as you turn the shaft, one increases in capacitance and the other decreases. Any idea, Mel, what kind of a circuit would you apply that to? Go ahead.
Okay, that is the circuit that the Johnson Kilowatt Matchbox bases its system on. And in fact, that is how they go about using that type of system with the link coupling, how they go about using balanced wire, 450 and 600 ohms, very popular balanced wiring that in fact go back to when the couplers were built back in the 50s. 300 ohm was a very popular type of wire to use for your dipole and all, because you'll see some of those old dipoles, especially those older dipoles, using 300 ohm wire, because 300 ohm wire was extremely cheap because it was used on old TV sets in the 40s and the 50s. So they came up with this kilowatt, or they say, should say the kilowatt and the different matchbox series, and they had the balanced feed, and that's how they did it, with a dual differential capacitance tuning system and using link coupling, so they didn't have to have any kind of a balance stick, over.
Sounds very nice. Now, when it comes to impedance matching, quite often you've got an antenna or any other kind of device you want to pour RF energy into. It could be the grid of a tube, it could be the cathode of a tube, it could be the input circuit of a traveling wave tube, it could be an exotic antenna, a simple antenna, an antenna after a certain length of feed line. There's a whole lot of circumstances in which you end up with anything but a 50 ohm resistor as the thing you want to pour RF energy into. And the device that you hang in between your transmitter and the thing you want the RF energy to go into, it might be a cloud chamber or some other crazy experiment. You might be doing an experiment like that ham radio operator that was on 60 Minutes a few months ago, who is discovering ways of using an RF transmitter, ham radio transmitter, for doing cancer irradiation research. In other words, by hyperthermia techniques using RF energy, he is finding ways of making improvements in a cancer cure. I didn't say he's got a perfect cure, but he's finding ways of making an improvement, because hyperthermia is a beautiful way of damaging the cancer cells more rapidly than the normal cells. Let me drop. So once you've got a situation where, I don't care if your load happens to be the finger or the arm of a human being, and you got two plates across that arm, coming to two wires into your transmitter, or any other kind of wild device you want to pour power into, by various techniques, you can find out what is the impedance of the device, of the thing that you want to pour RF energy into. A network analyzer, an antenna analyzer, antenna tuner. There's all kinds of ways I can't think of the name of this, a bridge-like device that people have used, noise bridge. There's various pieces of instrumentation, complicated, simple, expensive, cheap, whatever, by which you can find out what is the impedance you're working with that you want it to accept the RF energy. So even if the thing that you want to pour RF energy into is only partially resistive and partially reactive, doesn't matter. You choose the right L network, you choose the right pi network, you choose the right T network, you choose the right pi L, pi T, TL, whatever. There's various combinations of inductors and capacitors in various configurations that when you choose the right value of the capacitor and the right value of the inductor, at least at that frequency, if not a whole band of frequencies, you get a perfect impedance match. What I just told you is the truth. Here's the hard part. How do I design the right circuit to go between the two? You can study the appropriate chapters of the ARRL antenna book or the amateur radio handbook. And the theory section will give you a bunch of equations and a bunch of curves that help you design the right inductor, the right capacitor, the right configuration to give you a known impedance match with a tolerable amount of Q. You don't want the Q to be too high. You don't want the Q to be too low. There's a desirable Q region. For amateur circuits, they usually shoot for a Q of 10. You go higher than that, you get the excess current loss in your components. You go lower than that, you get very little tuning. So a Q of 10 is a desirable case for many amateur circuits feeding an antenna. There are other cases where you're feeding RF energy over a band of frequencies into, say, for instance, plates that are across a man's arm, and you would like the Q to be unity if you can get it, the lowest possible Q, the broadest possible bandwidth. I found a website this week, and you're going to want to write this one down. I found the website by Googling the word combination RF impedance matching. In other words, Romeo Foxtrot space impedance space matching.